You know, I do have people ask me, well, why does the center work only with men? And I really do like to share this because it's true. Women are just a lot healthier than men. They really are. You are. We do a real good job of putting up a front. We don't ever let anybody know who we are. And so much about the book, The True Measure of a Man, involves that issue and how men can truly break out of that and become really healthy. There's just something about us that are just naturally dysfunctional. And it's because of the culture that we live in, the front that we try to put up. And so, in all sincerity, I feel like the reason that we do what we do is because there's a real need in men's lives. Now, with that being said, you're probably wondering how I'm 61, but I wrote the book when I was 60. What in the world was a 60-year-old man thinking when he decided to write a book on the hookup culture that is clearly exists in our culture today? And the main reason is I really wrote it for my three children. I have three teenagers, one who will be going off to college next year, another who will be a senior next year, and another who will be a sophomore in college, in high school, excuse me. But I say that in all sincerity, but it's also really for anyone who recognizes what a significant issue this is and really want to know and understand more about it, because I do find that parents, in many cases, are somewhat clueless because this isn't something their kids come home and tell them about. Now, there were three things that took place that really led to me finally making the decision to proceed with this project. First and foremost, about 3 years ago, I heard a man speak who was an ordained minister, but he also coached a rugby team for one of the Ivy League schools. And he gave a wonderful presentation, but right there in the middle, he said, you know, I really love these boys that I work with. He said, but to listen to them talk about their sex lives, you would think they were describing a double X-rated movie. And then he said, I'm afraid if we don't do something, we're going to lose this next generation of kids. Now, I'm not sure what he meant when he said lose them, but it really was a very chilling thought for me personally, because I have three children that are in this generation that he's referring to. Then 2 years ago, my daughter went to a summer camp, and she was in a cabin with 10 or 12 other young girls. She was 14 at the time. And she had this wonderful counselor, a young lady who was going to be an upcoming senior in college. I had a chance to meet and talk to her, and she was just lovely. Just a very sweet, kind woman. And later, my daughter shared with me a conversation that they had. Not surprisingly, in the midst of the camp, they got into a conversation about sex. And my little girl shared with me how this counselor very courageously and very transparently shared about her life in college and how she had been involved in what's called a friends with benefits relationship with some young man. And she explained basically they would just have sex, kind of like you would go out and play tennis, just kind of an activity. There was no commitment. They were just friends. And then the counselor just said, and she said, this is very common with co-eds in college. And she says, whatever you do, don't get involved in something like this. It's a dead-end street. Now, when she shared this with me, my daughter, I was stunned. I really was. But that, again, that impacted me. And since I do speak and teach and communicate and write, I began to get the idea of maybe possibly writing something very short on this that I could really go through with my kids. But I think the thing that really convinced me, and I mean, I felt like God wanted me to do this, but what really kind of really convinced me was I read a book, and some of you I know are familiar with it. It's called The End of Sex. The author is a Dr. Donna Freitas, and she was a really important resource that I used in writing the book and in doing my research. And what caught my attention, the reason I read the book, not so much of the fact it was titled The End of Sex, but listen to what the subtitle was. How the hookup culture is leaving a generation unhappy, sexually unfulfilled, and confused about intimacy. And what you saw was she did a very objective study interviewing 2,500 college students from around the country. She took not only personal interviews, but she used certain, I don't know what you would call them, maybe a kind of a survey. And she took all of this and put it together and wrote this book. And after I read the book, I had a real heavy heart, and that was when I felt like I need to go forward with this. And so this past summer, I really wrote it and completed it. What's interesting is since then, since the manuscript was completed, I want to share with you two things that I think are significant. I don't know how many of you saw, it was in the news, and was a big story about these two football players at Vanderbilt. Do you remember it? Who basically were charged with sexual assault and rape of a co-ed there at Vanderbilt. These two young men were both, I think, 19 years old. And the young woman was like 20. And what you find out in the circumstances is that she was passed out drunk. And the two boys were very intoxicated. And I won't tell you what they did to her. But they fortunately got on film the fact that they had pictures of them taking this girl down to their room. But what I find interesting is, in the trial, the defense that these lawyers gave for these two boys was, one, they said, they argued that these young men were too drunk to know what they were doing. And then this was what I found to be interesting. It says, these boys are living in a new culture in college, a new culture of binge drinking and promiscuous sex, that they have been raised in what's called the hookup culture. And they said, therefore, they should be absolved of their guilt because this is what's going on in college today. And yet still they were, and rightly so in my opinion, they were found to be guilty. And this is what's so tragic. These two young men may spend 10 to 15 years of their life in jail. The second point that I want to make just real quick is that I have a niece who is graduating from college this spring. And she read the manuscript. And recently I happened to see her, and she came up to me and she said, Uncle Richard, everything you say in that book is what's going on at college today. Nothing that you said in there was incorrect. It's right on. It's spot on. So what I thought I might do is take a few minutes just to kind of share with you the content of the book. Almost everything that I'll share with you is in the book, and there's more. And then a few other comments that I've probably will make just along the way. It's kind of been interesting because when people recently have asked me this last night, are you working on any new books? You know, I try to explain it to them, and some of them are not even familiar with some of the terminology. You know, what is a hookup? What does that mean? Well, my definition is, a hookup is simply when two people accept and participate in casual sexual encounters that focus only on physical pleasure without any type of relational commitment or emotional bonding. In most colleges today, sex has become another form of recreation that you fit into your schedule, like studying or exercising. Now, in her book, The End of Sex, Dr. Freitas says that this has become the norm on college campuses. And then she says, in order to do this, though, you have to become hardened about sex and forget about romance. She says the most frequent complaint that she got, probably from young women, but also from young men, is that there is no dating culture anymore. That students don't date. That now they might have homecoming, they might have some big event where they get it, but you just don't see where young men and young women go out to eat and sit and talk and chat or go to a movie. So this just doesn't happen anymore. And she says the hookup culture's primarily influence is those students who go to college with the intent of having a very active social life. That's they see that as a big part of college life is their social life. And you see most of this happens in the Greek culture. Not exclusively, but that's what she says. Now, I don't know about you, but when I was in college, there was plenty of sexual promiscuity. But I want to tell you, something's changed. Something has radically changed that our kids are faced with or will be faced with in the years to come. And people ask the question, this is what I really spent a lot of time on, how did we get here? How did we get to this place? And I think that there are four primary issues, or there are four, I would guess you could call them forces, that when they come together, have a powerful influence on our young people. And the first, and it shouldn't be surprising, but the first powerful force is pornography. It's a huge issue today. It's played a major role in this hookup culture, and what it's done is primarily it's changed the attitudes, particularly of young men, of the role women should play in a sexual relationship. And the problem, that the reason, I guess you could say, the pornography is such a powerful force is that, number one, it's so easily accessible. And it enables a young man, and young women use it, but primarily young men, it enables them a commitment-free sexual gratification. And this may be most significant, it's so easy to hide. Nobody knows that you're doing it. You see, what I'm finding is that a majority of young men in colleges today are addicted to pornography, and most of their parents are clueless. I had a guy come see me recently to talk about another issue, and then he shared with me, he says, my son is coming home from school tomorrow, from college. Now, I have a tremendous respect for this man. He is just one of the finest people you'd meet. And I don't know his son, but I've heard he is an outstanding young man. And he said, my son is coming home to see me. He called me last night and said, Dad, I've got a problem. I'm addicted to pornography. And I need your help. The good news is that the son felt comfortable enough to go to his dad. But I think the father was stunned because he's such an outstanding young man in all that he did. It's a real problem today. Now, so that's the first powerful force. It's different from when I was, I realize I'm older than most of y'all, but I was talking to a guy the other day who's like 42, and he said, you know, when I was in school, he said, if we were going to watch pornography, we would do it at the fraternity house. He said, but you'd have to go to a seedy area of town to rent a video, and nobody really wanted to do that. And then we'd bring it back, and we might watch it, and he says some people would watch it, some wouldn't. It was kind of embarrassing. But that's no longer the case. You can see that's changed. Now, the second force, and this shouldn't surprise anybody, is alcohol. Now, alcohol has probably been used frequently throughout the student body at most colleges, you know, go back 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. But what's changed is not so much that students are drinking, but it's how much they're drinking. It's called binge drinking. Some they go out with the intent of getting just extremely intoxicated. That's the intent. And so many students today, and this is what I read in a number of books, so many students today will go out with their friends, get really intoxicated, and then find themselves waking up the next morning naked in the bed with somebody they don't even know and they don't really know what they've done. And so you can see when you drink to that extent, you can see what it can potentially do to you. Now, a third force, not surprising, I won't spend much time on this, is just the peer pressure involved. In my book, The True Measure of a Man, I thought this has a huge impact on men in that we worry greatly about what other people think about us. And one of the most powerful forces in a man's life is a fear of rejection. And so basically what students are finding when they show up on a college campus as a freshman, if they don't want to participate in this, they're going to be left out. It says a student from Princeton said, "Those who do not adhere to, and particularly those who publicly question the tenets or practices of the hookup culture, are thus considered unaccepted, unwelcome, or abnormal." Now, I don't think I have to tell any one of you how powerful peer pressure is in the life of a young person. It's also true in our lives. It's amazing what the fear of rejection can do to a person's life and what it can make them do. Now, the fourth and the final issue, or the fourth force that we've seen this new modern hookup culture come to pass, is a change in how our society determines what is sexually moral and immoral. You see, in most of our country's history, there was a predominant view of morality. It still is called the Judeo-Christian view, which holds that there is an objective moral standard or an objective moral order that has been dispensed to us by God, and that we are called to submit our lives to it. And when we do, our lives and our relationships will flourish. In other words, there's this outside standard that's been dispensed to and given to us by God, and we submit our lives to it. But that's changed, particularly among our young. I talk about this a good bit, that there's a second view of morality, and it's very modern, and it contends that morality today is subjective. In other words, we get our sense of morals from within, from the heart, from the desires. And therefore, what I think might be right and moral, you may not. I have my moral truth and you have yours. And I'll respect yours and you respect mine. And this view is predominant among college campuses today. In the book, I talk about how David Brooks says that, unfortunately, most college kids today don't know how to talk about what character means. You ask them, what is it? How do you tell the difference between right and wrong? And they don't know. They don't know what to say. The problem with this view, it makes few moral demands on a person's life and says philosophically, there really is no rules for sex. But you know what? You think about it, it also is a theological statement that says God does not care how I should limit my lust or how I should channel my passions and desires. So you take these four forces and they all come together in the lives of our young people and you can see what potentially will happen. And so the question that I think I was asking as I contemplated writing this book, and maybe you're asking as well, is where is this taking us? Where is this taking us as a country? Where is it taking our culture? But more significantly, where is it taking our young people? I mean, will it have an impact on their future relationships, or is this just a non-issue? Well, for you to get a good picture, I'm going to read, this is in the book, but this I'm quoting Donna Freitas. All of her research, all of her study, all of her interviews, she says this. One of the common responses that she got from the students she interviewed is how sad and unhappy they are about hooking up. They all fear that it will rob them of healthy, fulfilling sexual relationships in the future. In Freitas' own words, at its very worst, hooking up made students feel miserable and abused, and some students claim that all it took was a hookup gone wrong and your entire college experience could be ruined, that one night could make or break your life at college for good. She said, so many of the students regret the missed opportunities of relationships that could have been. She goes on to say, I quote, on a personal level, most of these same students didn't want to be thought of merely as someone to have sex with right after a night of drunken partying or someone to walk away from without a care. Men and women both spoke of how they wanted to be made to feel special, to experience what it was like when someone else wanted to know everything about them. They yearned for someone to make an effort to create a beautiful setting in which such knowing and being known could occur, for someone who would set aside lavish amounts of time for this to take place. The women and men harbor secret wishes for what appear to be the old-fashioned trappings of romance and seem symptomatic of hookup culture's failings. What they want is everything that hookup culture leaves out. The hookup is not liberating at all if what young men and young women really want is to go out on dates and just to spend time with each other and get to know each other. Now, there are a lot more consequences just of their unhappiness and this sense of emptiness that they experience. And this is huge, and I'm going to come back to it because I mentioned a minute ago. But it's really scary what pornography is doing, particularly young men. Again, it's so, as I said, it's easy to hide. It's easy to be addicted to. It's hard to stop. And most young men in college today are struggling with it, and they don't have anybody to go and talk to and tell. And they don't realize the devastating effects it can have on their relationships and their future life. Let me read this to you. Pornography can easily give a person an easy escape from real life and all of its pain, but it creates all types of problems, many of which evolve slowly, so that you never really see them coming until they're quite serious. The most alarming consequence is that it causes sexual desire and functioning difficulties and often shapes one's sexual interests in destructive ways. And then I quote a number of people on this. I'm going to give you one. A Dr. Ursula Hoffman, she's a Manhattan-based sex therapist. She says she's seen many young men coming in to chat about their porn-related issues. It's so accessible, and now with things like streaming video and webcams, she says guys are getting sucked into a compulsive behavior. What's most regrettable is it can really affect relationships with women. I've seen young men lately who can't get aroused with women but have no problem interacting with the internet. And what I'm seeing, this is what I'm seeing. Too many young men today are graduating from college with a double addiction hanging around their necks, an addiction to pornography, an addiction to alcohol. And it's like they've dug themselves a deep hole, because when it gets right down to it, it makes it very difficult for them to go out and start life in the real world, particularly as they begin a career, get married, and have children. And this is what I've learned. I've got two sons, and over the last few years, we've talked extensively about this. And they've read. In fact, I would just say this. They are scared to death of it. I've gotten to the point where they are really scared of it. And if nothing else, if you can get your sons and daughters just to read the part of the book on pornography, it will put the fear of God in them of what it can potentially do to their lives. But they don't know this. Another thing is it's just harmless fun. I just real quick, I shared a different message down at, I won't mention the college, but a fraternity at a college, a big fraternity. There's probably 100, 125 men there at the talk. And I was speaking on, I do this often, on my previous book, A Life of Excellence. And it was the talk, the message was going great, and then out of the blue, because this was this fall, I'd already completed the manuscript, it just came out of my mouth. I said, I told them what I just told you. I said, so many young men, so many of you are going to graduate from college and have a double addiction of alcohol and pornography, and it is going to be a real problem in your life. And I want to tell you, you could have heard a pin drop in that room. I could tell that it was speaking right into their lives. So pornography is a huge problem, the consequences of it. And then you've got, and I won't spend much time on this, but nobody talks about this, and that is STDs, sexually transmitted diseases. You know, when I was in college, there were two STDs, just two. Today, there are 25, and that number is increasing. Miriam Grossman, who's a psychiatrist, that she was at the mental health department at UCLA, worked with students daily. She says this, 43% of college co-eds were shocked that they had HPV, which is a type of STD for women. She says there are certain STDs that are not curable. They will be with you for life, like herpes. And then she says, if you're going to be involved in the hookup culture, she says, it is most likely you will get a sexually transmitted disease. Now, that's the first half of the book. And my wife says, it's kind of depressing. The second half is much more uplifting and probably is the most important part. But you got to kind of get people's attention before you can talk about, well, what do we do about this? Now, let me just say this. In chapter 5 of the book, which is kind of midway, because I think sometimes I did this because I think it's very easy to think, you know, this really isn't happening at my kids' college. I mean, this is overblown. So in chapter 5, I just lay out kind of the evidence of so much of what I read. And it's really fascinating. And it validates what I've said. I'm going to read one to you real quick. There's a book that came out called College of the Overwhelmed. It's an intriguing book that came out several years ago. One of the authors, Dr. Richard Cattison, is the chief of mental health services at Harvard and a national expert in the field of campus mental health. The opening lines of the book are quite revealing. He says, this is a book about the extraordinary increase in serious mental illness on college campuses today and what we can do about it. The book goes on to explain how college students are stressed out. The book goes on to explain how college students they have left the security of their home, they face academic competition, they're dealing with new relationships, and are confronted by all types of cultural expectations. For many students, it becomes more than they can handle, and for this reason, you see a dramatic increase in depression, eating disorders, substance abuse, and suicide. It's no wonder that today's students are drawn to pornography, alcohol, and hooking up. For so many, they serve as a means to medicate the pain and immense pressure that's in their lives. Now, in the second half of the book, I start off by talking about how we get our ideas about life. I mean, you think about how your life develops as you grow up. You begin to develop ideas about how life works. And our ideas are important because they determine so often the choices we make, the decisions we make, and the priorities that we have in our lives. But the problem is, if you know anything about philosophy will tell you this is the one thing that's true about ideas. They can be true, or your ideas can be false. And that there are major problems when our ideas about life are false. Now, in my counseling philosophy, one of the things that I really kind of as foundational is some words from probably Einstein believed he was the smartest man to ever live, Blaise Pascal. Pascal says that the reason people have problems and struggles in their lives is because they have false ideas about reality. And therefore, he says, if you really want a high quality of life, he says, you need to seek to gain wisdom and uproot false beliefs and replace them with truth. And this is what I found to be true in the lives of men that I meet with who are struggling with life. They generally have false ideas and false perceptions. It may be about masculinity. It may be about what is true success in life. It may be about what is true wealth. What does it really mean to be wealthy? And there's an illustration I use that I think would be you would appreciate. And think about it as it relates to what we're talking about. It's one that comes from Stephen Covey. And I share this with men all the time, and it's like a light goes on. But imagine you were going to the city of Chicago for the first time. You've never been there before. You get there at night, you go to your hotel room, you spend the night, you come down the next morning, and you ask them for a map of the city. Because you want to go out, and there are all these things you want to see. And you receive a map from the front desk, but what they don't realize is that the map that they've given you, the printer made a mistake. They were brand new, and really it's a map of the city of Detroit, but it says Chicago across the top. And you go out, and you try to make your way around the city of Chicago with a map of Detroit. And you find that you are utterly lost. And you think, what am I going to do about this? Well, you think, I'm going to try harder. I'm going to put more effort into it. And so you go faster and harder, but you're just as lost as you were. Or you say, I'm going to get a better attitude. I'm going to change my attitude because it's not real good right now. You know, you can come up with any strategy that you want to come up with. But until you get the right map, you're going to be lost. And I share that because really what I'm trying to do, what I try to do in the second half of the book, is help people get the right map as it relates to their sexuality and sexual intimacy. And, you know, the problem is when you have false beliefs, you have a belief about something and it's a false belief, it's so destructive because we're not aware that what we believe is wrong usually until we get burned by the belief. There's a guy, George Leonard. He was a very well-known author, and he was an educator. He wrote 15 books. At one time, he was editor of Look magazine, which I think has kind of gone by the wayside. He died 5 years ago. But he was an interesting man. He believed, and he was a big proponent of the sexual liberation movement. He believed that you should be able to have sexual relationships with whomever you want and whenever you want. And then late in life, he stunned everybody that knew him. He wrote a book. Ironically, the title of the book is the same title of Donna Friedis' book, The End of Sex. But his subtitle was Erotic Love After the Sexual Revolution. And he says this, I quote, he says, I finally come to see that every game has a rule and sex has rules, and unless you play by the rules, you'll find that sex can create a depth of loneliness that nothing else can. And it strikes me, if Leonard is correct, that sex has rules, he came from no biblical point of view, he just says, but if sex has rules, and ignoring them can lead to painful consequences, that it's only natural for us to ask, what are the rules? And who makes them? And this is when I began to talk about the fact that it only seems to make sense that God makes the rules. It starts with Him, because sex was His idea. I mean, if you think about it, sex could have been nothing more than just a way to procreate and have children with no pleasure to it, no meaning to it. But that's not the way God designed it. In fact, it seems logical that if sexual intimacy was God's idea, that He must have a blueprint that leads to the ultimate sexual experience. And then in the seventh chapter, I think this is the best chapter of the book. In fact, you could just take this chapter and probably make a copy of it and share it with a 12, 13, or 14-year-old. Because it talks about what is the purpose of sex. I think it's very uplifting. And it struck me that as parents, you know, when your kids are whatever age you decide to talk to your children about their sexuality, it's hard. You have to admit it's tough. And what we think sometimes that what we really need to do, and it's important to do, is explain to them what is going on physiologically between a man and a woman. We explain to them about sexual intercourse. We tell them this is the way you have children. You know, it's the birds and the bees talk. And if you try to explain to them, and if you're coming from a biblical standpoint, you try to tell them, and it's only, you only have sex when you're married. But so many parents, I think, stop there. That's kind of all they say, and that I don't think that has a lot of appeal to kids. And therefore, I think that's why it's important to explain the purpose. And there is a woman by the name of Donna Gresh who wrote a wonderful book called What Are You Waiting For? And she just, I think, lays it out beautifully. And she says, she goes back to the Old Testament. And she says, you know, in the Old Testament, whenever you see a husband and wife having sexual relationships, the English translation is he lay with her. Or he had relations with her. But the Hebrew word is the word yada. Now, yada in English means, you know, boring or meaningless conversation. But yada in Hebrew is an active word, an action word, and it means to know, to be known, and to be deeply respected. Using the Hebrew definition, sexual intercourse is not just for pleasure, but rather its function or purpose is to know or to be deeply known by someone else. And deep down, isn't this really what everybody wants? She also points out that a frequently used Hebrew word that's parallel to yada is the word hesed, H-E-S-E-D, which means deep friendship, loyalty, devotion, and kindness and unselfishness. It's faithful love. Now, in the Old Testament, not all sex is the same. For instance, when David commits adultery with Bathsheba, it says, if you read it in the English, it says, he lay with her. But the Hebrew word that's used is not the word yada. It's the word shakab, S-H-A-K-A-B, which is a euphemism for sexual intercourse. Gresh goes on to say it's often paired in the Hebrew language with the word sikba, which means emission. I don't mean to be crass here, but in other words, shakab means to exchange body fluids, which if you think about it is what animals do, but unfortunately, this is actually a good description of hookup sex. And I truly believe this is why so many students are finding the hookup culture to be so unfulfilling and so meaningless. Now, when you move to the New Testament, you see Jesus quote the Old Testament. In Matthew, this is really beautiful. Matthew 9, verses 4 and 5, Jesus says, He who created them from the beginning made them male and female and said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Now that word cleave, in fact some translations don't use the word cleave, but it's a Hebrew word that's very significant and very important. The word cleave means absolute union. To cleave to someone is to say, I completely belong to you. Exclusively, permanently. Everything I have is yours. I am yours. And what Christ is saying is that's what we say to one another. That's what we bring to marriage. And he's saying basically that God made sex for cleaving. He designed sexual intimacy so that one person could say to another, I belong completely and exclusively and permanently to you. All of me, everything. And when you think about that, you see how the hookup culture cheapens sexuality when it's just another form of recreation and pleasure that has no boundaries. Let me read. This is really powerful. God is quite clear about this. You should never give someone your body if you've not given them your whole self. Otherwise, you're just an object for someone's pleasure. This is why you marry, radically giving yourself unconditionally to someone else, your entire being. When you follow this prescription, your sex life will soar. When we settle for something less than God's blueprint, sex becomes routine, boring, and utterly meaningless. All right, in the very last chapter of the book, I talk about why we're here. In his famous Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Denial of Death, Ernest Becker says, God has become irrelevant in so many people's lives, and that modern people don't seem to have any real purpose in life. And therefore, people, particularly young people, look to sex and romance to give them a sense of significance. And therefore, what you see today is that God has been displaced by sex. Campus psychiatrist Miriam Grossman, who I mentioned earlier, who worked at UCLA for a number of years with the students, says over time, she began to realize that college health and counseling centers focus on promoting health through diet, exercise, sleep, physical exams, not smoking, and using condoms. But they never encourage students to consider ways to nurture their souls. And she believes because of the pressure students are under academically, socially, sexually, that she has seen a large percentage of them on a spiritual search. They're experiencing a real thirst in their souls, and they're realizing that sex and all the pleasures of life won't quench that thirst. I think C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity describes our dilemma this way. He says, human beings over the centuries have looked for all types of ways to invent happiness for themselves outside of God, and it is out of these hopeless attempts that we have produced so much misery in the world. Lewis describes the long, terrible story of man trying to find something other than God which will make him happy. And then he goes and gives a very logical explanation why it will never work. He says the reason why it can never succeed is this. God made us, invented us as a man invents an engine. A car is made to run on gasoline, and it would not properly on anything else. God designed humans to run on himself. He himself is the fuel our spirits were designed to burn, the food our spirits were designed to feed on. There is no other. That is why it is no good just asking God to make us happy on our own without bothering about having a relationship with him. God cannot give us a happiness and peace apart from himself because it is not there. There is no such thing. I want to leave you. This is an illustration that I use, and it's in the book. I saw a youth leader do this years ago with a group of high school students. And what he did was he was talking about what does it mean to be free so that you can go out and live your life and be happy and do what you want to do with no restrictions, because that's what so many people think life is all about. And he brings out on a table and he puts a goldfish bowl with a single goldfish. And he says, you know, this is such a confining life for this goldfish. I'm going to set him free. And he reaches down and he takes the fish and he puts him on the table. And for about a minute, that fish is jumping all over the place. It's almost like he's dancing. He's having such a good time. And then he falls on the floor and he jumps around a little bit more. And then after about a minute, he lays there, his gills straining for oxygen. He's dying. And, of course, all the little girls out there say, put him back in the bowl, put him back in the bowl. And he eventually picks him up and puts the fish back in the bowl. And he says, this is important to realize. That fish was free to do whatever he wanted to do outside of the bowl. But he said, in reality, a fish cannot be a fish. A fish cannot really soar in life. A fish cannot be what a fish was meant to be outside of water. And he says, just as a fish is made for water, we were made for God. Our lives will soar when we live in relationship with Him. And that there is this deep thirst in the soul that only He can quench. Augustine said it best, and I'll leave you with this. He said, Lord, You have made us for Yourself, and our hearts will not find rest until they rest in Thee. And that's kind of how I close the book up. Thank you all for being here.